On this April the 15th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. President Biden signing an executive order imposing new sanctions on Russia for attempting to interfere in the 2020 election, the massive hack against the U.S. government as well as corporate networks, and Russia's actions in Crimea. On Capitol Hill, congressional Democrats introducing legislation that would expand the Supreme Court from 9 to 13 justices. But for now, Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying the legislation will not come to the House floor for a vote. If you have the Pfizer vaccine, you will likely need a third dose of the COVID vaccine within 12 months of becoming fully vaccinated. That news we learned today from the drug maker. It's also unclear how long protection from various vaccines would last. And the company's CEO saying people may need to be vaccinated again next year for coronavirus and perhaps in future years. Meanwhile, the pause on Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine in the U.S. will last at least a week, perhaps up to 10 days. This after a CDC advisory panel today announced it needs more time and more information on the risk of those rare blood clots. All 50 states have now put a pause on the distribution of the vaccine after six women developed those clots. Nearly 7.5 million doses had been administered across the U.S. And Dr. Anthony Fauci getting into a war of words with Republican Congressman Jim Jordan during a House Coronavirus Crisis Subcommittee hearing. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House, where late today President Biden announcing a series of sweeping sanctions and diplomatic expulsions. This is a way for the administration to punish Moscow for its interference in the 2020 elections, the SolarWinds cyber attack, and claims of severe human rights abuses in Crimea, which Russia is currently occupying. Now, the announcement is the latest in what has been a series of foreign policy steps this week by the administration, along with the decision that we talked about earlier this week here in the program, the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, and the plans to send an official delegation to Taiwan to express support for democracy and security there. We'll talk to David Sanger of the New York Times on what all of this means for the U.S. and our global posture around the world. But first, today's announcement at the White House by President Biden.
Earlier this week, I spoke with President Putin of Russia about the nature of our relationship, the relationship between our two countries. And I was candid and respectful. The conversation was candid and respectful. Two great powers with significant responsibility for global stability. And President Putin and I have had a significant responsibility to steward that relationship. I take that responsibility very seriously, as I'm sure he does. Russia and Americans are both proud and patriotic people. And I believe the Russian people, like the American people, are invested in a peaceful and secure future of our world. During the campaign for the presidency, I was unequivocal that if I was elected president, I'd respond to any attempt to influence our elections, the last election, and because elections are sacred. They're sovereign undertakings, and they're an expression of the will of the American people. And we cannot allow a foreign power to interfere in our democratic process with impunity. And I told them if it turned out that the as I thought, that there was engagement in our elections, that I'd respond. Later, during the transition, as we learned more about the SolarWinds cyber intrusion, I made clear that I would respond once we determined who had, in fact, conducted a hack on the scope and scale that occurred. When President Putin called me in January after I was sworn in to congratulate me, I told him that my administration would be looking very carefully, now that we had access to all the data, and at the issues that to assess Russia's role and then determine what response we would make. When we spoke again this week, I told him that we would shortly be responding in a measured and a proportionate way because we had concluded that they had interfered in the election and SolarWinds was totally out of the inappropriate. Today, I've approved several steps, including the expulsion of several Russian officials as a consequence of their actions. I've also signed an executive order authorizing new measures, including sanctions to address specific harmful actions that Russia has taken against U.S. interests. I was clear with President Putin that we could have gone further, but I chose not to do so. I chose to be proportionate. The United States is not looking to kick off a cycle of escalation and conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. If Russia continues to interfere with our democracy, I'm prepared to take further actions to respond. It is my responsibility as President of the United States to do so. But throughout our long history of competition, our two countries have been able to find ways to manage tensions and to keep them from escalating out of control. There are also areas where Russia and the United States can and should work together.
With more on today's announcement, we are joined on the phone with David Sanger. He is White House and National Security Correspondent for The New York Times and the author of the best-selling book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age, also an HBO documentary. Let me begin with some of the aspects of what we heard from the president, including the SolarWinds hacking. What was that all about?
SolarWinds was an attack that was not your usual form of hacking. This was not one of those cases where somebody sends you an email and tries to lure you into providing your password or something like that. Instead, it was a very sophisticated effort to get into software made, network management software made by a company called SolarWinds in Texas. I'm sure many of your listeners probably have never heard of SolarWinds, but they're well known in the corporate world because they make software that helps you manage loads across big networks. So a lot of companies use them, including the New York Times. A lot of government agencies use them, including Treasury, Commerce, the Energy Department, and many more. And by getting into this software as it was being prepared and as it was being updated, the Russians managed to put in code that you would then download into your systems, and the Russians suddenly had access the way an administrator, a computer administrator would, across all of the systems and into all of the emails and other files. It was a brilliantly done hack, if you're just sort of appreciating the artwork of this. To give you a comparison, it would be as if somebody got into the Apple updating system just before you updated your iPhone with the latest operating system. And once that happens, you basically got all access. And the government of the United States, our many intelligence agencies and others, didn't see this coming and didn't see it when it happened. It only got detected by a private security firm called FireEye when the Russians came in for them as well. So that was the hack, and the question was who did it? And today the U.S. government for the first time gave us their answer to that.
The president also made reference to Russia's interference in the 2020 election and the story that we talked about a while ago, those bounties on Afghanistan soldiers to kill American troops. What can you tell us about that?
So on the elections, we saw declassified U.S. Reports that indicated that the Russians had been active in 2020, although I can't say they were terribly influential. In fact, my own personal view, and this is not coming from anything that came out of the intelligence today, is that they knew that the U.S. was going to be watching the election system and election infrastructure so carefully that they really focused their attention I'm going after the SolarWinds way into government agencies and into corporations. The bounties was an interesting element today. The government said that they believed that Russia had put bounties on the heads of American soldiers. In other words, they were offering money if somebody, the Taliban, others, would go after American troops in Afghanistan. But they also cautioned that they had only low to medium confidence in that intelligence. And that's pretty fascinating because it tells you that, right now they couldn't prove a case in court or almost any other place that was the case. They're relying on basically the testimony of people who they'd captured along the way in Afghanistan. So that didn't appear to be a significant basis for the sanctions issue today.
We're talking with David Sanger. His latest book, The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. So based on what you heard from the White House today, is Russia in general and Vladimir Putin in particular paying a high price?
I would say that they're paying a medium price. The main sanction that was imposed was prohibiting U.S. banks from going into the market for new Russian debt, including debt issued in rubles. And this is how the Russian government finances itself. But the fact of the matter is the Russian government isn't running big debts right now. And the foreigners account for maybe a quarter of the Russian debt market for new issue. It does not keep American banks from trading in old Russian bonds, for example, existing Russian bonds. It leaves open the opportunity that those could be escalated in the future. So they're basically sending a message to the Russians that says, if you retaliate, we can make this worse. But it seemed to me to be a pretty calibrated response. Now, they also made clear that we haven't seen in public all the response. They've always said there would be seen and unseen elements. We assume the unseen elements are in the cyber world. It may take a while to see evidence of those.
The latest details available into the evening at nytimes.com and in tomorrow's newspaper. David Sanger here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
In other news, on a busy day here in Washington, the Associated Press describing it as, quote, a fiery exchange between a member of Congress and Dr. Anthony Fauci. A House Select Subcommittee hearing turned into a shouting match at times when Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan pressing Dr. Fauci on restrictions that had been put in place during this year-long pandemic. Also on hand, Congressman Jim Jordan, but also Jim Clyburn of South Carolina. Now, Dr. Fauci joined the CDC director and other medical experts to answer questions on how to safely navigate the country to the end of this coronavirus pandemic and what things will look like later in the year and into 2022. As Dr. Fauci spoke about how infection rates will go down, saying that there needs to be more flexibility with more people being vaccinated, the Republican congressman from Ohio repeatedly pressing him to pinpoint a specific number at which coronavirus-related restrictions would be lifted. Here's part of what unfolded.
And I don't disagree with that, and I understand how serious that is, but I also stand it's pretty serious when businesses have been shut down, people can't go to church, people can't assemble in their own homes with their friends, with their families, people can't go to a loved one's funeral, people can't get to their government, petition their representative to redress their grievances. Right. I also understand the First Amendment's pretty darn important, and it's been a year, and I want to know when right. Americans will get those First Amendment liberties right. back.
Well, you just said people cannot assemble in their own homes. They can. That's a CDC recommendation. For vaccination.
Not last fall they couldn't.
I didn't hear.
Not last fall they couldn't.
I didn't hear what he said.
The gentleman's time has expired. I'll give you one instance of when we can get our liberties back. It's when 90% of the members of the United States Congress get vaccinated.
Well, I want to know if that's what Dr. Fauci is. Is it 90%,
that's what
Dr.
I'm,
Fauci? Is it 90%? That's what I'd like to know. Give us some objective standards versus when certain things get reached, we might be able to get back to having our liberty. When? What are the numbers?
Well, you're going to see a gradual, right now we're at an unacceptably high level. We're at, on a daily basis, it's unacceptably high, regardless of who you are. What you're going to see as more and more people get vaccinated and we get over 3 million people a day, you're going to see the level of infection come down and down, and gradually there will be more flexibility for doing the things that you're talking
Where
about.
Where does it get to? When it comes down, what number do we get our liberties back? Tell me the number.
When 90% of the members of Congress get vaccinated.
But you're not a doctor, Mr. Clyburn. He is. What is the number?
I can't
Thank
give...
you for recognizing me, Mr. Clyburn. Thank
the chair
you.
Chair now recognizes for 5 minutes.
I'd like my question
Ms.
answered.
Ms. Malone.
Reclaiming my time. Reclaiming my time.
Regular order. Regular order.
No, just a moment.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want you to answer my question. The American people want Dr. Fauci to answer
well,
the question. What does it have to be?
Expire, sir.
If you need to respect the chair and shut your mouth.
Don't worry about this. We're going to handle this. And I think Mr. Jordan knows me very well, and he knows full well that we're going to handle this. Your time has expired, and the chair now recognizes
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Maloney.
That's from Congressman Jim Clyburn, along with Congressman Jim Jordan and Dr. Anthony Fauci, all from today's House subcommittee hearing. All of it posted on our website at cspan.org. Also today, we learned from the CDC that nearly 5,800 people who had been vaccinated against coronavirus became infected anyway. Some people seriously ill. 74 died, according to the agency. In addition, 396, or about 7% of those who got infected after they were vaccinated, required hospitalization. Now, this is the CDC's first public accounting of the breakthrough cases as the agency continues to search for patterns based on the patient's age, gender, location, the type of vaccine, the variants, and other factors. The CDC director also discussing what she is calling the scourge of racism in American society. She did so today in the same hearing that we heard from Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Rochelle Walensky pointing out to the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on communities of color, as seen in case numbers, deaths, and social consequence. Her remarks before the House subcommittee.
COVID-19 has underscored the importance of addressing long-standing systemic health disparities as a cornerstone of achieving health equity. And just this past week, I declared racism a serious public health threat and highlighted ways CDC will confront the impact of structural inequities to serve as a catalyst for greater education and dialogue around these critical issues. CDC is committed to expanding evidence-based approaches to reduce disparities in COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and death, to prioritizing equity in vaccine distribution, and to expanding a diverse workforce. CDC has announced a number of investments in alignment with these goals, including our largest single investment in health equity. CDC will distribute $2.25 billion to address COVID-19 health disparities and advance health equity among populations who are high risk and underserved. In addition, CDC has invested $3 billion to strengthen vaccine confidence with a focus on increasing uptake and equity, particularly in communities hardest hit by this pandemic.
That from the CDC director, who also launched a new web portal. It's titled Racism in Health. It's on the CDC website, designed to be a hub for public information as well as a dialogue on the issue of racism and health factors in America. Now to Minneapolis. Former police chief Derek Chauvin said in court that he will not testify in his murder trial. Shortly before, the defense said it has completed its case, and the prosecution also reiterating the same. And so today's development setting the stage for what will be closing arguments that will take place beginning on Monday. Here was the moment inside the courtroom with defense attorney Eric Nelson and former police chief, police officer Derek Chauvin.
Mr. Chauvin, you and I have had several discussions throughout the course of my representation of you relevant to your right to testify or to choose to remain silent, correct?
That's correct.
And during the course of our representation, it's fair to say that you and I have had this conversation multiple times, correct?
Correct.
You understand that you have a Fifth Amendment privilege to remain silent. Do you understand that?
Yes.
You understand that if you choose to exercise that right to remain silent, neither the state nor the court can comment on your silence as a sign or an indication of your guilt. Meaning they can't say he didn't get up and defend himself, so equate your silence with guilt. Do you understand that?
Yes.
All right. Now, you also understand that you can waive that right and testify. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
You understand that if you chose not to testify, or if you did in fact testify, you would be subject to cross-examination by the state of Minnesota?
Yes.
You understand that if you were cross-examined by the state, we could not attempt to limit the scope of your testimony. The state would be given broad latitude to ask you questions. Do you understand that?
Yes.
We've had this conversation repeatedly, correct?
Correct.
I have repeatedly advised you that this is your decision and your decision alone, right?
Correct.
I have advised you, and we have gone back and forth on the matter. Would be kind of an understatement, right?
Yes, it is.
But after a lengthy meeting last night, we had some further discussion, agreed?
Correct.
And have you made a decision today whether you intend to testify or whether you intend to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege?
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
From inside the courtroom, attorney Eric Nelson and Derek Chauvin, and with that, Judge Peter Cahill with this message to the jurors in the case.
Next step for you is to listen to closing arguments, and then retire for deliberations. That'll occur on Monday. The attorneys and I will still be working. We have a few administrative matters and legal matters to take care of, most importantly, going over the law that I will give you in my instructions. And that takes quite a while, and so we are not going to change our schedule. We're not going to close tomorrow. We're going to close on Monday. And so with that, remember, you will be sequestered. We have some of your questions, and we're going to try and answer as many of those as we can. I think the one thing that you need to know today as you leave is, how much do I pack? If I were you, I would plan for long and hope for short. Basically, it's up to the jury how long you deliberate, how long you need to come to a unanimous decision on any count. And so because that's entirely up to you, whether it's an hour or a week, it's entirely within your province. So that's how I would do it if I were you. We'll also give you some information probably Monday as you retire as to other questions that don't require your immediate attention. And we will also be probably giving you some hints as far as technology. We will be operating under the rules that are currently in place regarding audio and video evidence. And that is specifically that you'll be provided with a laptop computer that has all the audio and video, in fact, pretty much all the exhibits in this case, on the computer, and with a large monitor to play them. You will not have to come back into the courtroom each time you want to look at the audio or video, which is the old rules, which involves a lot of back and forth. We're not going to do that. We're just going to give you that computer with the arrangements so that you can view it as you deem appropriate as part of your deliberations. So with that, I wish you a good long weekend, and we will see you Monday morning. We will convene at 9 a.m. for closing arguments and final instructions. Thank you so much.
And that's from Judge Peter Cahill, 9 o'clock Central Time, 10 o'clock here in the East. Our live coverage will resume Monday on the C-SPAN networks. The closing arguments in the case against former police officer Derek Chauvin. On Capitol Hill here in Washington, the Senate voting 92-6 today to advance legislation that would strengthen federal efforts to address hate crimes directed at Asian Americans. The measure will create a new position, a position at the Justice Department, the goal to expedite the review of hate crimes related to the pandemic, to expand public channels to report on such crimes, and to require the Department of Justice to issue any guidance that would mitigate racially discriminatory language in describing the pandemic. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer delivering these remarks on the Senate floor earlier today.
Now, yesterday, an overwhelming bipartisan majority of senators voted to move forward on Senator Hirono and Senator Duckworth's anti-Asian hate crimes bill. I was pleased the vote was so substantial, 92-6. Rarely do you see 92 senators agree to move forward with any piece of legislation. But if there was ever a topic that deserves a strong showing of bipartisan support, it's standing up to bigotry and racism against a particular group of Americans. Today, we will continue to work on a bipartisan agreement regarding amendments. I've committed to start the process with the bipartisan Moran Blumenthal amendment. I understand my Republican colleague from Maine has some modifications to the bill, which we welcome, and those negotiations are proceeding afoot. I expect the Republican leader and I, in consultation with the relevant committees, will be able to figure out an appropriate number of reasonable, germane, non-gotcha amendments for the Senate to consider. We are working with Senators Moran and Grassley and Collins in a very bipartisan way, and we should be able to wrap up this bill next week. By doing so, the Senate will deliver a powerful message to Asian Americans that their voices are heard, their concerns are felt, and that their government will take swift, decisive action to protect them. They are not alone. Before I move on, I just want to say to my Republican colleagues, this is how the Senate can work, even though it's closely divided. When there's a pressing issue, like the rising tide of anti-Asian violence, the Senate can act quickly and in a bipartisan way to address it. We don't need to always distrust the other party. This bill was never intended to be a messaging bill or gotcha legislation. This bill is like a drive straight down the middle of the fairway, well-timed, modest, unobjectionable. At the end of the day, we can achieve a result that has both substantive and symbolic importance. Substantive, because we're going to adjust the focus of the Justice Department to better respond to anti-Asian hate crimes, and symbolic because both parties are standing up to deliver a message that racism and bigotry have no place in America.
From the Senate floor earlier today, that from Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. We should point out six Republicans voted against the Senate bill that would deal with hate crimes directed at Asian Americans. Those senators, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Ted Cruz of Texas, Josh Hawley of Missouri, Roger Marshall of Kansas, Rand Paul of Kentucky, and Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. We carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2. And there's this story from Politico.com. Senator Mitch McConnell had an unusual request for Senate Republicans this week. Say nice things about two Democrats. Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, under lots of pressure from liberal activists and their Democratic colleagues to buckle on the filibuster. This is what Senator McConnell told Senate Republicans yesterday, that the GOP should keep the moderate pair close and publicly praise them, saying that they could, quote, save this institution. And Politico is also quoting Senator John Thune, who had this sentiment: for me right now, they're almost the guardians of democracy because they're trying to protect us from the loss of the legislative filibuster and everything that would come with that. They're good people. They want to do the right thing. The full story at Politico.com. Meanwhile, in the House, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy saying that his colleague, Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida, is innocent until proven guilty. The congressman is under federal investigation for sex trafficking allegations, and leader McCarthy was asked about whether he will punish Congressman Gaetz.
The House Judiciary Committee has oversight of the Department of Justice. So is it appropriate that when a member of that committee is under investigation by the Department of Justice, that they stay on that committee, like Representative Gaetz?
Are you referring to is Matt Gaetz going to stay on committee? Matt Gaetz is the same as any American. He's innocent until proven guilty. There's no charges against him yet. If a charge comes forward, that would be dealt with at that time. Yes.
Oversight of the Justice Department.
Follow up on that. Is there anything that could come out in media reports before the probe concludes that would push you to remove?
That's a hypothetical question. I'll deal with whatever issue as it comes. As of right now, Matt Gaetz says he is innocent. There's an investigation going on, and I'll let the investigation take care of itself before I take any action.
Mr. Leader, have you spoken to Congressman Gaetz?
Yes, I have.
Can you tell us more about that conversation?
I've spoken to Mr. Gaetz about the accusations. He's told me he's innocent of the accusations. He explained to Mr. Gaetz the rules inside our conference. If there was something to come forward, we'd take action.
And those rules that the Republican leader Kevin McCarthy is referring to is that any GOP lawmaker that is charged with serious felonies would then lose their membership to those House committees. Meanwhile, news today on former Vice President Mike Pence. He had a pacemaker implanted yesterday after experiencing symptoms associated with a slowed heart rate. The procedure took place at the Inova Heart and Vascular Institute, which is part of Fairfax Hospital in Northern Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. The former vice president's office saying that he had been dealing with shortness of breath over the last couple of weeks and, after consulting with doctors, had the pacemaker surgically implanted. Doctors saying that the 61-year-old former vice president is expected to make a full recovery in the coming days. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this April the 15th. Normally the day you must file and pay your taxes, but federal returns have a new deadline this year. It is May 17th, in about a month. Here are some of your other headlines. News on the economy, where jobless claims dropping to 576,000 this past week. That, by the way, is the lowest level since the pandemic first hit. Retail sales surged nearly 10% in March, in part fueled by those $1,400 stimulus checks. And CNBC is reporting that 34 companies in the S&P 500 reporting first quarter earnings. Of those, 88% have beaten their estimates on average by 22%. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing today she has no plans to bring a Democratic-led bill to expand the Supreme Court to the floor of the House for a vote. The House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler is pushing to expand the court by four seats and is pushing for a vote on the House. The bill comes a week after President Biden signing an executive order forming a commission. That commission would look into the possibility of adding more seats to the Supreme Court and also reviewing the federal judicial system. Here is Speaker Pelosi.
Do you support Jerry Nadler's bill to expand the Supreme Court by four seats? And would you commit to bringing that bill to the floor?
No. I support the president's commission to study such a proposal, but frankly, I'm not. Right now, we're back. Our members, our committees are working. We're building the putting together the infrastructure bill and the rest. I don't know that that's a good idea or a bad idea. I think it's an idea that should be considered, and I think the president's taking the right approach to have a commission to study such a thing. It's a big step. It's not out of the question. It has been done before in the history of our country a long time ago. And the growth of our country, the size of our country, the growth of our challenges in terms of the economy, et cetera, might necessitate such a thing. In answer to your question, I have no plans to bring it to the floor, no.
And so with that, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Congressman Jerry Nadler of New York, responding to Speaker Pelosi's statements.
Just minutes before you all came out here, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she has no plans on bringing this bill up to the floor. So where exactly do you go from here? And were you disappointed by the Speaker's comments?
My view is that we are in an historic situation where this court is a 6-3 court because of illegitimate actions taken by a Republican United States Senate and a Republican president. The harm that court is going to be able to do across a whole range of issues, voting rights, woman's right to choose, environmental issues, issue after issue, are now in jeopardy. So my belief is that it's absolutely imperative that we introduce this legislation because it's going to become clear as decision after decision emanates from this Supreme Court that there needs to be a historic balance which is restored. So we begin this debate, we begin this discussion today, but it does not end here. And I believe that ultimately, it's going to be very clear that this legislation has to pass. I will turn it over to
I'll agree. Speaker Pelosi is a very good judge of events. Speaker Pelosi, I agree with Senator Markey. Speaker Pelosi is a very good judge of events and of history. And I believe that as events unfold, as the court comes down with decisions destructive to a woman's right to choose, as they come down with decisions destructive to the climate, as they come down with decisions destructive of civil liberties, I believe that Speaker Pelosi and others will come along.
With more on this story, we're joined on the phone here in Washington with Alex Swoyer. She is legal affairs reporter for The Washington Times. And let's go back to the bill put forth by Senator Markey and Congressman Jerry Nadler. Specifically, what does it do, and how does it get Congress there?
So specifically, it actually changes the number of associate justices from 8 to 12. So the court is comprised of a chief justice and then 8 associate justices right now. And then that would essentially, if this were to pass, make the court at 13 justices. So, of course, you need both chambers to pass this legislation and President Biden to sign it. And it doesn't look at this point like that's going to happen, at least in the near future.
And, of course, we heard from Speaker Pelosi that she has no plans to bring it to the floor, at least right now. So let's turn to the politics of all of this. What's Senator Markey, Congressman Nadler, these supporters of adding additional members to the Supreme Court, what does it give them?
Yeah, it was an interesting timing with the Speaker's statement today. She basically came out just before the press conference with Senator Markey and Representative Nadler, and basically said, you know, that she doesn't see herself bringing their bill to the floor. And the two of them were asked to respond to that. And their response was essentially that they believe that with time they can win her over. I think it was Jerry Nadler said that with a 6-3 conservative majority on the high court, there's going to be rulings coming down that are you run afoul of women's rights, could strike down climate protections. And so they think eventually Pelosi will be on their side and that their bill will get a vote. Now, her stance, of course, is along with President Biden, and she's saying she wants to see just as the president has, what his commission that he created through an executive order last week to study the Supreme Court says. And so that commission is supposed to look at what, you know, the pros and cons of expanding the court, as well as, you know, the lifetime and tenure of a justice, and other factors. So we don't have a date yet for when the commission is going to hold its first public meeting, but I do understand that after that date is set, they have 180 days to get their report to the president. So it could be months from now before, you know, Speaker Pelosi were to decide to move on this sort of call to expand the court.
And we should point out the court has remained at 9 justices dating back to 1869. In terms of the politics, we're hearing from Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois. He is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, advising Democrats to respond, quote, reasonably. And, of course, Senator Mitch McConnell has been very critical of this, saying that there's nothing about the judicial branch that requires a study.
Right. And you also have, I think it's very important to note, Senator Joe Manchin, who we know is like the most moderate Democrat in the Senate, has said today to reporters that, you know, he said he doesn't support expanding the court. So there's another one in terms of looking at a 50-50 Senate that would make the Democrats shy at least one vote. At this point, I guess things could change, like I said, when the commission issues a detailed report, but we should wait and see.
More details at WashingtonTimes.com. Alex Swyer, thank you for being with us.
Of course. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Also in Washington today, we learned from the Capitol Hill Inspector General that lapses in security led to the mob riots back on January the 6th. Michael Bolton testifying before the House Administration Committee, stating that the police on Capitol Hill at that time were ill-prepared and that faulty equipment did not work for the officers. And there was also a lack of intelligence information sharing. Here's a portion of his opening statement.
As our work continues, my office sees continuing areas in our findings that need to be addressed. Those areas are intelligence, training, operational planning, and a cultural change. In regards to a cultural change, the CIA department needs to move away from the thought of process of a traditional police department and to move to the posture of a protective agency. A police department is geared to being reactive for the most part, whereas a protective agency is postured in their training and planning to be proactive to prevent events such as January 6th. In conclusion, the department is comprised of extraordinary men and women who are dedicated to protecting our democracy, putting their lives in harm's way in order for Congress to exercise their constitutional duties in a safe and open manner. It is our combined duty to honor those officers who have given their lives and also ensure the safety of all those working and visiting the Capitol complex by making the hard changes within a department.
That from Michael Bolton. He is the Capitol Hill Inspector General. In a statement, the U.S. Capitol Police saying that the department welcomed the review and that it has made some changes, but acknowledges much additional work needs to be done. The report, one of three IG reports looking at what happened on January the 6th in the insurrection. Of course, 5 people died during those demonstrations inside the Capitol. Representative Zoe Lofgren chairs the House Administration Committee with this line of questioning to the IG.
Among the most troubling findings in your report is that officers were directed by the Capitol Police leadership not to use all available equipment, such as heavier, less than lethal weapons and corresponding munitions that included the 40 millimeter grenade launcher, the 37 millimeter grenade launcher, and sting ball grenades. I have 3 questions. Who specifically within the department issued this order and why was it issued? 2, would these heavier, less than lethal weapons have the capability of dispersing large crowds? And 3, would these heavier, less than lethal weapon systems enhance the department's ability to push back the insurrectionists?
Thank you, ma'am. Through our review, there was information that was provided to us that it was decided that these heavier munitions, say specifically the sting balls, 40 millimeter, were not to be utilized based on the information that we received that they could potentially cause life-altering injury and or death And if they were misused in any way, that could result in those things. Our feeling is that, well, that anything that you give a police officer can be misused. If it's misused, can cause life-altering injuries and or death. The takeaway from that is let's provide the training to our officers so that they are used appropriately. As far as your other part of your question, certainly would have provided the department at a better posture to repel these attackers. It would put them in a better position. It would be very difficult to say it would have absolutely turned the tide, but it certainly would have gave them a better chance at doing what they needed to do. One of the things during our interview process was when MPD heroically showed up as well, came to our help, when some of their officers started using the very sting balls, it was reported to us that individuals were turning around and leaving. They're very painful, these type of munitions. So certainly would have helped us that day to enhance our ability to protect the Capitol.
You said why the order was given not to use the less than lethal weapons, but were you able to identify who gave that order?
Yes, ma'am. The word we have, it was an assistant deputy chief.
From today's House Administration Committee, this is the headline at rollcall.com. The Inspector General cites glaring problems within Capitol Police. With more on that story, Chris Marquette is joining us on the phone. First of all, the significance of this report and what happens next?
So the report says that the Capitol Police Department needs to restructure its civil disturbance unit, which is its riot control, and overhaul its intelligence operation. It also needs to implement serious training changes and also make sure that they have appropriate plans in place when large-scale events are happening, such as, the January 6th insurrection. So as far as that goes, right now, a lot of the committees of jurisdiction, House Admin, Legislative Branch Appropriations, Senate Rules, and Homeland Security in the Senate are looking at this information. They're digesting it. They're holding a hearing, hearings. Today, IG Bolton, Capitol Police IG Bolton, testified before the House Administration Committee. And one thing that we learned today, which was interesting, was that in years past, the Capitol Police has been not implementing intelligence recommendations that the Inspector General has put forth. And that's important because one of the biggest issues in the Capitol Police's preparation and response to January 6th was several intelligence shortcomings, not a lot of communication internally. They got this January 5th report from the FBI Norfolk Bureau warning of a war at the Capitol, and that never made it to top officials at the Capitol Police, and those are a lot of issues that that Bolton cited in his IG report. He said there needs to be a full culture change, that the department needs to move away from the thought process as a traditional police department that's reactive in nature, and instead shift the police department's security posture to one that's a protective agency, one that is proactive to prevent events such as January 6th. And when it goes to one of the biggest issues that was cited in Inspector General's Bolton's report was that the Civil Disturbance Unit, which controls riots and large-scale events, did not have adequate policies and procedures for defining responsibilities. A lot of these Civil Disturbance Unit members were ill-equipped. They didn't have the equipment necessary to defend a large-scale riot. This is they're lacking helmets, they're lacking protective hard gear, things of that nature.
Which is why the report said that the department was woefully unprepared for the insurrection on January the 6th. But let me go back to your earlier point, the need for what they're calling a fundamental culture transformation among the Capitol Hill Police Department. What would that look like?
If you walk around Capitol Hill, you see Capitol Police officers in their uniform. That's the majority of the officers that you see. That's called the Uniformed Services Bureau. So what the Civil Disturbance Unit, the riot control, does is they Bolton describes it as an ad hoc unit. So what they do is they pull officers from the Uniformed Services Bureau, which is about 1,400 officers. It's usually the younger officers because there's not a lot of incentive to be in that unit, and they pull from that. And one of the recommendations that Bolton has made is to have a dedicated force to control riots and things of that nature, and possibly incentivize members of the department to apply or try to be part of that unit by offering, he described it as a signing bonus or some sort of monetary incentive to get these officers interested in being a part of that unit. But right now it's highly dysfunctional.
More details at rollcall.com. Chris Marquette, thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, some big gains. The Dow rising 305 points, the S&P up 45, the NASDAQ jumping nearly 181 points, and some big earning gains for Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Alphabet. They all climbed more than 1%. On our podcast, The Weekly, we look back at 50 years of the Congressional Black Caucus. In 1971, then-President Richard Nixon refusing to meet with a group of black lawmakers, one of the reasons the caucus was formed. The number 3 House Democrat, Congressman James Clyburn, shares his stories with this observation on the challenges ahead for the Congressional Black Caucus.
It's going to stay focused, stay in touch with the dreams and aspirations of the people who look to you for leadership, not necessarily who you may represent. I'm the only African-American in the Congress from South Carolina. But South Carolina is a state of over 4 million people, and right around 29% of whom are African Americans. So though I have one of the 7 districts, there are African Americans in all of those districts that look to me to help with the fulfillment of their dreams and aspirations. And the Congressional Black Caucus has that same role to play on the national stage.
And this year, marking the 50th anniversary of the Congressional Black Caucus with Congressman James Clyburn, you can listen to The Weekly every Friday afternoon, 5:30 Eastern Time, here on C-SPAN Radio, or anytime you can download the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcast. And this program, Washington Today, it's also a podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully in Washington for the Thursday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.